said simultaneously when they pulled up in front of it. And then, as they sat there in Nick's sister's car, gazing at it for a few seconds, they both made rising, sounds, which meant, but maybe it's got something. It was a ramshackle two-story Federation house with a sagging roof, blankets hanging in the windows instead of curtains, and an overgrown junkyard lawn. It looked sad and battered, but if you squinted your eyes, you could see the stately home it had once been. The for sale sign out front said Potential Plus, and everyone knew what that meant. Too much work, said Nick. Far too much, agreed Alice, and they gave each other sidelong, suspicious looks. They got out of the car and stood shivering on the street, waiting for the real estate agent to arrive. The front door of the house creaked open, and a bent old lady wearing a man's jumper over a check shirt, long socks and sneakers came shuffling up the footpath toward the letterbox. Oh, God, said Alice in agony. It was bad enough when you caught a glimpse of a harried middle-aged couple rushing out to their car to drive away before you went stomping through their house, making disparaging remarks about their choice of carpet. It broke Alice's heart when she saw the things they did to try to make their house sell. The fresh flowers, the kitchen counters with wet streaks from where they'd been vigorously wiped, the coffee plunger and cups placed just so on the living room table to make it look homey. Nick would snort cynically when people lit scented candles in the bathroom, as if that's the way they always lived. But Alice was always touched by their hopefulness. Don't go to all that effort to try and impress me, she wanted to tell them. And now here was this ancient, trembly old lady. Where would she go on this freezing day while they looked at her house? Had she scrubbed the floors on arthritic knees for their appointment when they probably wouldn't even buy it? Hi, called out Nick, while Alice shrank behind him, saying, shh. He pulled her out from behind him, and because she didn't want to have a full-on wrestling match in public, she had no choice but to walk along beside him toward the old lady. We're meeting the real estate agent here in a few moments, explained Nick. The old lady didn't smile. Your appointment isn't until 3. Oh, no, said Alice. There was something a bit familiar about the time 3 o'clock, and she and Nick were always getting things like that wrong. God help you if you two ever have children, Nick's mother had said to them once. Sorry about that, said Nick. We'll go for a drive around the neighborhood. It looks beautiful. You may as well come in now, said the old lady. I can do a better job of showing it to you than that smarmy weasel. Without waiting for an answer, she turned around and started shuffling up the path toward the house. Nick whispered in Alice's ear. She's going to put us in cages and fatten us up before she eats us. Leave a trail of crumbs, whispered back Alice. Shaking with repressed laughter, they obediently followed her. There were 2 stately sandstone lions at the top of the veranda stairs guarding the house. Their eyes seemed to follow Nick and Alice as they walked by. Rawr, whispered Nick to Alice, lifting his hand like a claw, and Alice said, shh. Inside, the house was better and worse than they'd expected. There were soaring ceilings, ornate cornices and ceiling roses, original marble fireplaces. Nick quietly kicked back a corner of fraying old carpet to show Alice wide mahogany floorboards. At the same time, there was a nose-tickling smell of damp and neglect, gaping holes in plaster, ancient moldy bathrooms, and a kitchen with 1950s linoleum, and a stove that looked like it came from a museum. The old lady set them down in front of a single bar heater and brought them cups of tea and a plate of Scotch finger biscuits, waving away Alice's desperate offers to help. It was excruciating to watch her walk. She finally sat down with a dusty black old photo album. This is what the house looked like 50 years ago, she said. The photos were small and black and white, but you could still see that the house was once beautiful and proud, not the shrunken skeleton it had become. The old lady pointed a yellowed fingernail at a photo of a young girl standing with her arms outspread in the front garden. That was me on the day we moved in. You were so pretty, said Alice. Yes, said the old lady, I didn't know it, of course, just like you don't know how pretty you are. No, she doesn't, agreed Nick solemnly, who was eating his third stale scotch finger as if he hadn't eaten for a month. I should be leaving this house to my children and grandchildren, said the old lady. But my daughter died when she was 30, and my son doesn't talk to me anymore. And so I'm putting it on the market. I want $200,000 for it. Nick choked on his biscuit. The ad had listed it at over $300,000. The real estate agent will tell you I want a lot more, but I'm telling you if you offer that much, I'll accept. I know I can probably get more than that from an investor who will do it up quick sticks and sell it on, but I was hoping a young couple might buy it and take their time restoring it and bring back the happy memories. We had a lot of happy memories here. Even though you probably can't feel them, they're here. She spat out the words happy memories with slight disgust. It could be beautiful, continued the old lady as if she were reprimanding them. It should be beautiful. Just a bit of spit and polish. Later in the car, they sat and looked at the house silently. Just a bit of spit and polish, said Alice. Nick laughed. Yeah, gallons of spit and truckloads of polish. So what do you think? Asked Alice. Should we forget it? We should just forget it, shouldn't we? You go first. What do you think? No, I want you to go first. Ladies first. Okay, fine, said Alice. She took a breath and looked at the house, imagining fresh paint, a mowed lawn, a toddler running around in circles. It was madness, of course. It would take them years to fix it all up. They didn't have the money. They were both working full-time. They didn't even own a car. They had agreed they would not buy a house that needed anything but superficial renovations. She said, I want it. Nick said, I want it too. Alice was in seventh heaven. Everywhere she looked, there was something new and wonderful to see. The big square sandstone pavers leading up to the veranda, Nick's idea. The glossy white wooden window frames with glimpses of cream-coloured curtains. The pink bougainvillea climbing frothily up the trellis at the side of the veranda. She could swear she'd only just thought of that idea the other day. We'll have our breakfast there and pretend we're on a Greek island, she'd told Nick. Even the front door, for heaven's sake. At some point they must have finally got around to stripping it back and painting it. We had a list, she said to Elizabeth. Do you remember our list? It was 3 foolscap pages of things we needed to do to the house. There were 93 things on that list. It was called The Impossible Dream. The last thing on that list was white stone driveway. She bent down and picked up a smooth white stone and showed it to Elizabeth in the palm of her hand. Had they crossed everything off that list? It was nothing short of a miracle. They had achieved the impossible dream. Elizabeth smiled tiredly. You made a beautiful home, and wait till you see inside. I assume you've got your keys in your backpack there. Without needing to think, Alice bent down and pulled out a fat jangle of keys from a zippered pocket at the side of the backpack. The key ring was a tiny hourglass. She knew where it would be, but she had never seen it before. She and Elizabeth walked up onto the veranda. It was beautifully cool after the heat. Alice saw a set of cane chairs with blue cushions. She loved that shade of blue. And a half-empty glass of juice sitting on a round table with a mosaic top. Automatically, she went over and picked up the glass, hefting her backpack over her one shoulder. She kicked against something with her foot and saw it was a black-and-white soccer ball. It rolled away and hit the wheel of a child's scooter lying on its side, with shiny ribbons tied around the handles. Oh, she said in sudden panic. The children. Are the children in there? They're with Nick's mother. It's his weekend for the kids. Nick is back from Portugal tomorrow morning, so he'll drop them back to you Sunday night, as usual. As usual, repeated Alice faintly. Apparently that's your usual procedure, said Elizabeth apologetically. Right, said Alice. Elizabeth took the glass of orange juice from Alice's unresisting fingers. Shall we go inside? You probably need to lie down for a while. You still look so pale. Alice looked around her. Something was missing. Where are George and Mildred? She said. I don't know who George and Mildred are, said Elizabeth in a gentle, dealing-with-crazy-person-here voice. That's what we call the sandstone lions. Alice gestured at the empty spot on the veranda. The old lady left them for us. We love them. Oh, yes, I think I remember them. I expect you got rid of them. Not quite the look for you, Alice. Alice didn't understand what she meant. She and Nick would never have got rid of the lions. Just off to the shops, George and Mildred, they'd say as they left the house. You're in charge. Nick would know. She would ask him. She turned around and lifted the keys to the door. The locks were new to her. There was a solid-looking gold deadbolt, but her fingers instantly found the right key, holding down the door handle and pushing with her shoulder against the door in a practiced, smooth movement. It was extraordinary the way her body knew how to do things. The mobile phone, the makeup, the lock, without her mind remembering her ever having done them before. She was about to comment on this to Elizabeth, but then she saw the hallway and she couldn't speak. Okay, listen to me, because I am a visionary, Nick had said, standing in the musty dark hallway, in the first shell-shocked week after they'd moved into the house. His mother had cried when she saw the house. Imagine sunlight flooding through this hallway because of the skylights we'll put here, here, and here. Imagine all this wallpaper gone, and the walls painted something like a pale green. Imagine this carpet gone somewhere far, far away, and the floorboards varnished and shiny in the sunlight. Imagine a hall table with flowers and letters on a silver tray, you know, as if they'd been left there by the butler. And an umbrella stand, and a hat stand. Imagine photos of our adorable children lined along the hallway, not those horrible portrait shots. But real photos of them at the beach or whatever, or just picking their noses. Alice had tried to imagine, but she was suffering from a bad cold, and one nostril was stinging so badly it was making her eyes water. And they had $211 in the bank, and 20 minutes ago they'd just discovered the house needed a new hot water system. All she could say was, "We must have been out of our minds." And Nick's face had changed, and he'd said desperately, "Please don't, Alice." And now here was the hallway, exactly as he'd described it. The sunlight, the hall table, the floorboards shining liquid gold. There was even a funny old antique hat stand in the corner covered with straw hats and baseball caps and a few draped beach towels. Alice walked slowly down the hallway, not stopping, only touching things with a vague caressing fingertip. She looked at the framed photos. A fat baby crawling on hands and knees in the grass, gazing huge-eyed up at the camera. A fair-haired toddler laughing uncontrollably next to a little girl in a Spider-Man suit with her hands on her hips. A skinny brown boy in baggy wetboard shorts, caught ecstatically mid-air, bright blue sky behind him, arms and legs flailing in every direction, droplets of water on the camera lens as he crashed down into unseen water. Every photo was another memory Alice didn't have. The hallway led out to what had been the tiny living room where the old lady had given them tea and biscuits. Their plan had been to knock down three walls in this back area. It was Alice's idea. She'd drawn it up on the back of a Domino's pizza napkin, so that it would create a huge open space where you could be cooking in the kitchen and see right out to the jacaranda tree in the back corner of the yard. "You're not the only visionary around here," she'd told Nick. And now, here it was, almost exactly as she had drawn it, but even better. She could see long, sleek marble countertops in the kitchen, a huge stainless steel refrigerator, and complicated appliances. Elizabeth walked into the kitchen as if it were just an ordinary kitchen, and poured the glass of orange juice down the sink. Alice dropped her bag on the floor. There was no way this divorce talk could be serious. How could they be anything but blissfully happy living in this house? "I can't believe it," she said to Elizabeth. "Oh, look, I knew white shutters would be perfect on that back window. Nick wanted timber, although I see he won on the tiles. Nope, but I have to admit, he was right. Oh, and we found a solution to the weird corner. Yes, perfect. Oh, I don't know about those curtains. Alice, said Elizabeth, have you actually got any of your memory back? Oh my God, is that a pool out there? A swimming pool? An in-ground swimming pool? Are we rich, Libby? Is that what happened? Did we win a lottery? What did you tell them at the hospital? Would you look at the size of that television? It's like a movie screen. She knew she was babbling, but she couldn't seem to stop. Alice, said Elizabeth. Alice's legs felt wobbly. She went and sat down on the brown leather couch, expensive, in front of the television. Something dug into her. She pulled out a tiny plastic toy, a figure of a murderous-looking man carrying a machine gun under one arm. She placed it carefully on the coffee table. Elizabeth came and sat next to her. She handed her a sheet of folded paper. Do you know who this is from? It was a handmade card with glitter stuck to the front and a drawing of a stick-figure woman with a turned-down mouth and a band-aid on her forehead. She opened it and read out loud, Dear darling mummy, get well soon. Love from Olivia. It's from Olivia, of course, said Alice, fingering the glitter. And do you remember Olivia? Sort of. She had no memory whatsoever of Olivia, but her existence seemed indisputable. And what did you tell them at the hospital? Alice pressed her hand to the still tender spot at the back of her head. She said, I told them that some things were a bit hazy, but I remembered most things. They gave me a referral for a neurologist and said if I kept having any significant problems to make an appointment. They said I should expect to feel totally back to normal within a week. Anyway, I think I actually do remember bits and pieces. Bits and pieces? The doorbell rang. Oh, said Alice, that's beautiful. I hated that old doorbell. Elizabeth lifted her eyebrows. I'll get it, she paused. Unless you want to get it. Alice stared at her. Why shouldn't Elizabeth answer the door? No, that's fine. Elizabeth disappeared down the hallway and Alice laid her head back against the couch and closed her eyes. She tried to imagine what it would be like when Nick dropped the children off on the following night. Her natural instinct would be to throw her arms around him like she did when he'd been away. She had a distinct feeling that she hadn't seen him in ages, as though he'd been away for weeks and weeks. But what if he just stood there, without touching her back? Or what if he gently pushed her away? Or shoved her away? He would never do that. Why was she even thinking such a thing? And the children would all be there, milling about, doing whatever kids do. Alice whispered their names to herself. Madison, Tom, Olivia. Olivia was a pretty name. Would she tell them? Sorry, I know your face, I just can't quite place you. But she couldn't do that. It would be terrifying for a child to hear their mother didn't remember them. She'd have to pretend until her memory did come back, which it would, of course, soon. She'd have to try and talk to them in a natural voice, not one of those jolly, fake voices people put on for children. Kids were smart. They'd see right through her. Oh, heavens, what would she say to them? This felt worse than trying to think up appropriate conversation topics before going to one of Nick's scary work parties. She heard voices coming down the hallway. Elizabeth came in, followed by a man pushing a trolley piled with three cardboard boxes. Apparently they're glasses, said Elizabeth. For tonight. Where do you want 'em? Grunted the man. Said Alice. For tonight? I guess just here in the kitchen, said Elizabeth. The man lifted the boxes onto the counter. Sign here, he said. Elizabeth signed, he ripped off a sheet of paper, handed it to her, and looked around him briefly. Nice house, he said. Thank you, Alice beamed. There was a shout from down the hallway. Alcohol delivery. Alice, said Elizabeth. I don't suppose you remember anything about hosting a party tonight. Chapter 13. Together they flipped to the date in Alice's diary. "Kindergarten cocktail party," read out Alice. "7 p.m. What does that mean?"
"I'd say it means that it's all the parents from Olivia's class," said Elizabeth.
"And I'm hosting it?" said Alice.
"Why would I host it?" "I believe you host a lot of these sorts of things."
"You believe? Don't you know? Don't you come to all these things?"
"Well, no, this is to do with the school," said Elizabeth. "It's all mothers. I'm not a mother."
Alice looked up from the diary and said, "You're not?" Elizabeth seemed to flinch.
"No, I'm not. I haven't had any luck in that regard, so anyway..." She seemed desperate to get off of the subject. "What are you going to do about this party?"
But Alice didn't care about the party. There was no way she was going to host any kindergarten cocktail party. She said, "So will you tell me what happened, please? Did you try again to get pregnant after you had that miscarriage?" Elizabeth's eyes slid away. Franny's letter to Phil.
"So the village minibus was pulling out of the driveway, and all of a sudden there was a commotion. It was Mr. Moustache, do you mind, running alongside the bus, rapping his knuckles on the window, shouting, 'Wait for me!' I thought there must have been some crisis, but no, he was just running late. He leapt aboard, all breathless and excited, as if we were off somewhere far more thrilling than the local shopping centre. He announced to the entire bus that he'd been held up on the phone, placing a bet on the doggies. 'I think that means greyhound racing, Phil.' Charming. There were plenty of spare seats, but for some reason he chose to plonk himself down next to me. It was uncomfortable. He's not a large man, but he did seem to take up a lot of room. I found I was pressing myself against the side of the bus so our thighs didn't touch. Also, he was close enough that I could smell some sort of aftershave or cologne. I'm not saying it was unpleasant. It just seemed overly personal. I said something about the weather, but he ignored that and said, 'How's that honorary family of yours?' I found myself telling him about Alice's accident and how she didn't remember anything about her marriage breakdown. I told him how worried I was about the children. He told me a rather sad story about his own son, who had gone through a divorce, and how his daughter-in-law didn't let them see their grandchildren anymore. 'It broke my wife's heart,' he said. He told me that his wife had died 2 years ago, and that he truly believed she would have lived longer if her grandchildren hadn't been taken from her. When we got to the shopping centre, I naturally assumed he would go off and do his own thing, but he cheerfully admitted he didn't have a thing to buy, and he'd be happy to keep me company. I'd had enough of him by now, but I couldn't think of a polite way to get rid of him. So he followed me around while I bought talcum powder for Alice. I needed some new deodorant at the chemist's, but I was too embarrassed to buy it in front of him. As if deodorant could only be purchased in private. Isn't that the most ridiculous thing you ever heard? Also, we couldn't seem to synchronize our walking. We kept bumping into each other and treading on each other's toes. It was driving me a little batty, to be honest. I'm sure it was his fault, not mine. I am perfectly able to walk alongside other people. You and I used to go on such long walks, never a problem. At one point, we saw a toddler sitting in one of those toy cars. The child was having a tantrum, screaming, 'Just one more turn,' at his poor, harassed mother. Next thing, Mr. Moustache took a coin from his wallet and leaned past the toddler and popped it in the slot to activate the ride. Of course, the toddler shrieked with delight while the poor mother didn't know what to do. We were having quite a spirited argument about this. I felt that he had rudely undermined the young mother's authority when he suddenly got all excited by a pink neon sign advertising free iced donuts with your coffee. He insisted on buying me a cappuccino. For something to say, I told him about Ben and how he designs rather beautiful neon signs for a living. And that led to us talking about Elizabeth's problems. He was very sympathetic to Elizabeth,
and strangely, that made me want to argue with him. I said that babies weren't the be-all and end-all, and that Elizabeth might do better to concentrate on her marriage and her lovely husband. He asked whether I'd ever had a lovely husband myself. I said no. Then I got a little snappish and said that my donut was stale. That was a fib. It was actually quite delicious. Elizabeth's homework for Dr. Hodges. It was surreal hearing Alice ask me if I tried again, so wide-eyed and respectful. I nearly laughed. I wondered if it was an act. It's been a long time since I've thought properly about those early losses, as you call them, with a straight-mouthed grimace, as if you're constipated. I sort of hate that face you pull, Dr. Hodges. I bet your wife does, too. It always makes me think about what else I could be doing with the $150 I spend on you. I remember in one session you wanted me to start talking through the early losses. Grimace, grimace. And I gave a dramatic sigh and said I didn't think I could, but really, I was just so irritated by that expression on your face. Mostly now I just think of my losses as bullet points on my medical history. If a doctor asks me for my history, I can reel off every single procedure and test and crushing disappointment without even a tremor in my voice, as if they don't mean a thing, as if they happened to somebody else. So I can say, second first trimester miscarriage in April 2006, without blinking, and I don't even think about what it was like or how it felt. I want you to know that I've missed all of Grey's Anatomy now. I'm really working hard on this therapy. I wish you were grading me. You should give grades to your approval-seeking patients. I remember how happy we were when we got pregnant again, because this time, for some reason, we managed a natural pregnancy. That was to be my January baby, due on 17 January, the day after Ben's birthday. Imagine if it was born on the same day. But no, shh, don't say that out loud. We kept the pregnancy a secret this time. We thought that telling everybody about the first baby had been our beginner's mistake. I imagined announcing my second pregnancy with calm, womanly confidence after I'd passed the first trimester. It seemed a more grown-up, safer way to handle things. Oh, no, not an IVF baby this time, I'd say casually. A natural pregnancy. This time, we didn't talk about names, and Ben didn't pat my stomach when he kissed me goodbye each morning. We said things like, if I'm still pregnant at Christmas, and lowered our voices to a whisper when we used the word baby, as if getting our hopes up had been the mistake, as if we could trick the gods into not noticing us sneakily trying to have a baby. This time, Ben was there for the first ultrasound, and we both dressed up carefully as if it was for a job interview, as if our clothes would make a difference. The woman doing it was young, Australian, and a little cranky. I was worried, but on the other hand, I was faking it for the cameras, if you know what I mean. I was all twitchy nerves on the surface, but deep down, part of me was enjoying observing my anguish. Oh, look at her digging her nails into her hands as she lies down. The poor, traumatized thing. When of course there was going to be a heartbeat this time, because this sort of thing doesn't happen twice. I could already feel the huge rush of relief that would be released. I had tears of joy banked up that were just waiting for me to push go. I was ready to send a poignant message of love to my first baby, something along the lines of, I will never forget you, I will always hold you in my heart. And then it would be time to focus on this baby, our real baby. Alice's baby would only be a few months older. We could still call them twins. The cranky girl said, I'm sorry. Ben clenched his jaw hard and took a step back, as if someone had just threatened to hit him in a pub brawl and he was trying not to get involved. I've heard so many professional I'm sorries now, Dr. Hodges. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Yes, your colleagues in the medical profession are all very sorry. I wonder if one day you'll be the next to say, kindly and sadly, I'm sorry, but I can't cure you. You're a nutter. It might be time to look at other options, like transplanting somebody else's personality. I was embarrassed that it had happened twice in almost exactly the same way. I felt as if I was wasting people's time, constantly turning up for ultrasounds of dead babies.
What, you thought you had a real live baby in there? Don't be ridiculous. Not you. You're not a proper woman with these half-hearted, faintly ridiculous attempts to have a baby.
There are women out there with proper swollen pregnant stomachs and live-kicking babies. Afterward, I felt it had been wrong not telling the family about the baby, because then I wanted them to know about the miscarriage so that they knew the baby had existed. But when I told people, they seemed more interested in the fact that I'd kept the pregnancy a secret. They felt they'd been tricked. They said things like, "Oh, I did wonder that day when you didn't drink at the Easter barbecue. But you said you just didn't feel like drinking." In other words, liar. Ben's mother was offended. We had to take her out twice for a buy one, get one free meal at the Black Stump before she forgave us. The point of it seemed to be that I'd hidden the pregnancy, not that I'd lost the baby. People weren't as upset as with the first one, and how could they be when they'd only just heard it existed in the first place? I felt this ridiculous protective feeling for my January baby, as if nobody loved her, as if she wasn't as pretty or as smart as the first baby. I know she was a girl. This time they sent off the fetal material for testing and told me it was a chromosomally normal female. They said they were sorry, but they couldn't find any reason why I'd lost the baby. They said there was a lot they didn't know about miscarriage, but according to the statistics, I still had an excellent chance of having a healthy baby next time. Chin up. Try again. A week after the D&C, such a chipper name for something so horrible, I never feel so desolate as I have after waking up in recovery from a D&C. I went to visit Alice in hospital and see her new baby girl. Of course, Alice said I didn't need to go, and Ben said he didn't want me to go, but I went. I don't know why, but I was determined to do everything I normally would. I went to the greeting card store and chose a card frosted with pink glitter saying, "Congratulations on your darling little girl." I went to Pumpkin Patch and bought a tiny yellow dress with embroidered butterflies all over it.
"It just makes you long to have a baby girl, doesn't it?" cooed the sales lady.
I wrapped up the dress in pink tissue paper and wrote on the card, and I drove to the hospital and found a parking spot and walked through the corridors with a present under one arm and some trashy celebrity magazines for Alice under the other. The whole time I floated alongside myself, impressed. "You're doing fine. Well done. It will all be over soon and you can be home watching television." Alice was on her own in the room, breastfeeding Olivia. My own breasts still ached and burned. It's so mean-spirited of your body the way it keeps acting like you're pregnant even after the baby has been scraped out of your womb.
"Oh, look at her," I said to Alice, ready to begin the new baby patter.
I'm so good at it these days. Just last week, I went to visit a friend who had given birth to her third child, and even if I say so myself, my performance was flawless.
"Look at his tiny hands. Oh, her eyes, nose, mouth is just like yours. Of course I'd love a hold, and breathe, and chat, and smile." "Don't think about it. Don't think about it. Don't think about it."
There should be Oscars for that sort of thing. But Alice didn't let me get started on my act. As soon as she saw me, she held out the arm that wasn't holding the baby, and her face crumpled, and she said, "I wish it was me visiting you." I sat on the bed with her and let her hug me. Alice's tears dripped straight onto Olivia's soft, tiny, bald head, but she kept right on sucking Alice's nipple as if her life depended on it. She's always loved her food, that kid. I'd forgotten all about that day until now, how much it meant to me that Alice cried so genuinely for me. It was like she was taking on some of my grief. I thought, it's okay, I can do this. I can get through it. I'll be fine. I just didn't realize that this would keep on going and going and going. I think we may have just had a mini breakthrough in my journal writing therapy. Although no need to get too big for your boots, Dr. Hodges. It wasn't like I'd repressed that memory with Alice. I just hadn't thought about it for a while. But still, bravo. Maybe there is something in this, even though I've just missed what was promised to be an explosive episode of Grey's Anatomy. I'd toughened up by the next loss. Elizabeth said, "You're not just pretending you don't remember so you can make some sort of point, are you?" Alice felt the same punched-in-the-stomach feeling as when Nick had yelled at her on the phone. He'd said something about her making a point too. Had she become a person who had points to make? What sort of point? Forget it, I was just being paranoid. Elizabeth stood up and walked into the kitchen. She stopped in front of the refrigerator. It was covered with magnets, notices, photos, and children's drawings. I wonder if there's an invitation here for this party of yours. Alice twisted on the couch to watch her. Her head ached. Libby, please, what sort of point? I don't understand. Sometimes you talk to me like you... Well, it's almost like you don't like me anymore. Ha! Elizabeth picked up something off the fridge and brought it over to her. Here's the invitation. There's another woman's name on it for the RSVPs. You should ring her and ask if she can change the party venue. She went to hand it over, but Alice ignored it. Elizabeth sighed. Of course I still like you. Don't worry about it. There's nothing to worry about. Here, this woman's name is Kate Harper. Actually, I think I've heard you talk about her before. I think you're quite good friends with her. She looked expectantly at Alice. I've never heard of her, said Alice dully. Okay then, said Elizabeth. Well, why don't I call her and you can go upstairs and lie down? You look like death warmed up. Alice looked at Elizabeth's lined, anxious face. Have I let you down? Have I lost you and Nick? Chapter 14. Alice stood in the middle of her unfamiliar bedroom, looking for something, anything that belonged to Nick. There was no sign of him. No pile of books or magazines on his bedside table. He liked bloodthirsty thrillers, they both did. War histories and business magazines. No cylindrical piles of coins taken from the pockets of his trousers each day. No ties draped over the door handle. No giant dirty sneakers. Not even a lone crumpled t-shirt or sock. They were both messy. Their clothes were normally tangled together on the floor in flamboyant embraces. Sometimes they purposely asked people over just to give themselves the incentive to clean up in a frantic rush before they arrived. But the carpet, dark maroon, she had no memory of choosing it, was pristine, newly vacuumed. She went to the wardrobe. They'd found it lying on its side outside someone's house for council pickup. It was autumn, like now. They brushed away a layer of crackly brown leaves to reveal patterned mahogany. It was filled with spaced-out, good, heavy hangers, containing beautiful clothes that presumably belonged to Alice. Although it gave her fleeting pleasure to feel the lustrous fabrics as she flipped through the hangers, she longed to see just one of Nick's shirts. Even a boring white business shirt. She would wrap its sleeves around her like his arms, bury her nose in the collar. As she closed the cupboard door and slowly looked around the bedroom, she realized it smelled and felt essentially feminine. There was a white lacy duvet on the bed and a row of small shiny blue cushions. Alice thought the bed looked absolutely beautiful. Actually, it was her dream bed. But Nick would have said that all that prettiness would render him instantly impotent, so fine if that's what she wanted. He was just warning her. There was a Margaret Olley print hanging above the bed that Alice knew would have made Nick wince as if hit by a sudden attack of nausea. The dressing table had rows of different colored glass bottles. What exactly is the point? Nick would have said. And a crystal vase containing a big bouquet of roses. This was the bedroom she would have created for herself if she were living on her own. She always wanted to collect beautiful glass bottles and thought it was something she would never do. Except for the roses. She remembered how the image of exactly those roses had popped into her mind while she was in the ambulance yesterday. She went over to the dressing table and studied them. Who gave her those? And why was she keeping them in her bedroom when she hated that sort of arrangement? There was a small square card sitting next to the vase. Nick? Nick wanting her back and forgetting she didn't like roses? Nick making a point by sending her roses he knew she would hate? Alice picked it up and read, "Dear Alice, I hope we can do that again one day. Next time in the sunshine? Dominic." Oh, God, she was dating. She plonked herself down on the end of the bed, holding the card between disbelieving fingers. Dating was meant to be something from her past, not something from her future. She'd never enjoyed it that much anyway. The self-conscious, trapped feeling when you're sitting in a car together for the first time. The constant horrifying possibility of food caught in between your teeth. The sudden feeling of exhausted boredom when you realized it was your turn to come up with the next stilted topic of conversation.
"So what do you like to do on the weekends?"
Oh, sure, yes, there was nothing better than when a date actually worked. She could remember the euphoria of those early dates with Nick. There was a night where they'd watched Australia Day fireworks from a bar in the rocks. She was drinking a huge creamy cocktail, and Nick was telling a story about one of his sisters, and he was so funny and so sexy, and Alice's hair looked nice and her shoes weren't hurting, and there were curls of shaved chocolate floating on top of her cocktail, and Nick's hand massaging her lower back, and she felt such an intense sensation of happiness it frightened her, because surely there was a price to pay for this sort of bliss. And was this the price, all these years later? Nick swearing at her on the phone from the other side of the world? Had she finally been sent an exorbitant bill? A date with any man other than Nick would be boring and awkward and stupid. Dominic. What sort of a name was Dominic? In a sudden rage, she took the card and tore it into tiny pieces. How could she betray Nick like that by keeping these flowers in her bedroom? And then there was that other man, that physiotherapist from Melbourne, who had sent her the card with the mention of happier times. Who was he? Was she already onto her second relationship after breaking up with Nick? Had she turned into a hussy? A point-making hussy who went to the gym and upset her beloved sister and hosted kindergarten cocktail parties. She hated the person she'd become. The only good part was the clothes. This all had to stop. She had to get Nick's coins and his socks and his sneakers back in her bedroom, and these roses gone. She lay back on the bed. Elizabeth was downstairs phoning up that Kate Harper woman trying to get tonight's party cancelled. Alice crawled across the bed, pulled back the duvet, and got into crisp, clean sheets, still wearing her red dress. She looked at the ceiling, plastered and painted, the water stains and cracks gone as if they'd never existed, and thought of that moment in the bathroom at the hospital when she'd been going through that odd makeup routine, and she had that rush of feeling after she smelled her perfume. It had seemed like she was about to fall headfirst into all her memories, but then she deliberately resisted it, stepped back from the edge when she really should have let herself go. It would be far easier and less confusing if she could just remember what the hell was going on in her life. She sniffed at her wrist where she'd sprayed the perfume that had seemed so evocative of everything. But this time, she experienced only a confused, choppy mass of half-remembered feelings. They were insubstantial and slippery, gone before she could even attempt to name them. She woke to find Franny sitting at the end of her bed holding a gift.
"Hello, sleepyhead."
"Hello." Alice smiled with relief because Franny looked exactly as she should. She was wearing a familiar pale pink buttoned-up blouse Alice had seen many times before, or at least one like it, and tailored grey pants. Her back was ramrod straight. She was like a little elf. She had short white hair tucked behind tiny ears, creamy white skin, and cat's-eye glasses on a gold chain. Alice said happily, "You haven't changed a bit. You look just the same."
"You mean as I did 10 years ago?"
Franny adjusted her glasses on her nose.
"I guess there was no more room for any more wrinkles.
Here." She handed her the present.
"You probably won't like it, but I wanted to get you something."
Alice sat up in bed.
"Of course I'll like it."
She unwrapped a bottle of talcum powder.
"Lovely."
She twisted the lid, poured some into her palm and sniffed. The scent was simple and flowery and reminded her of nothing.
Thank you.
How are you feeling? Asked Franny.
You gave us all a fright.
Fine, said Alice, confused. Sometimes I feel like I'm on the verge of remembering everything, and then other times it all feels like a huge practical joke, and you're all just pretending I'm 39 when you know perfectly well that I'm about to turn 30.
I know that feeling, said Franny reflectively. Just the other day I woke up and felt like I was 19. I went into the bathroom and saw an old lady staring back at me from the mirror, and it really startled me. I thought, who is that dreadful old crone?
You're not a crone. Franny waved her hand at that dismissively. Well, anyway, I think you're probably having a nervous breakdown.
Alice looked appalled.
Don't look at me like that. People do have nervous breakdowns, and you've been under so much stress lately. What with this divorce?
Yes, about that. Why are we breaking up? Interrupted Alice. She couldn't bring herself to say the word divorce out loud.
Franny wouldn't try to hide anything from her. She would tell her straight.
But Franny said, I have absolutely no idea. That's between you and Nick. All I know is that you both seem very set on the idea.
There doesn't seem any chance of reconciliation. So we've all just had to button our lips and accept it.
But you must have an opinion. You always have an opinion.
Franny smiled. Yes, I generally do, don't I? But in this case, I really don't know. You haven't confided in me.
It's very sad for the children.
Especially this awful fighting over custody business.
I don't approve of that at all, as you know.
I don't know. I don't remember.
Oh, well, I've made my opinions on the matter clear. Too clear, you might say.
Alice said, Do you think I can get him back?
Who back? You mean Nick?
But you don't want him back, said Franny.
Actually, you talked to me on Wednesday and said you'd just received roses from some new fellow called Dominic. You seemed very excited about it.
Alice looked with dislike at the roses. She said sourly, I thought you said I was stressed.
Franny said, Well, yes, you're stressed, but you were happy about the roses.
Alice sighed. How are you, Franny? You're still living next door to Mum, right?
No, darling, Franny patted Alice on the leg. I moved myself into a retirement village 5 years ago, just after your mother moved in with Roger.
Oh, Alice paused to consider this news.
Do you like the retirement village? Is it fun?
Fun, said Franny reflectively.
That's what's important these days, isn't it? Everything should be fun and light-hearted.
Well, not everything, obviously.
Do you think I have a sense of humour? Asked Franny.
She gave Alice a look that was surprisingly vulnerable.
Of course you have a sense of humour.
Although sense of humour weren't exactly the first words that came to mind when you thought of Franny. Franny sighed and smiled. She wasn't an especially smiley lady, so when she smiled, it was like receiving a gift.
Tell me something. Would you buy deodorant in front of a man, or would you think that was too personal?
What man? Said Alice.
Any man, said Franny irritably.
Well, I think I probably would. There's nothing especially personal about deodorant.
Unless, I guess, you had to use some really heavy-duty one that would make him think you had some sort of rare and horrible perspiration disease.
I can assure you, Alice, I don't need a heavy-duty deodorant, said Franny, looking affronted.
What's this about? Asked Alice.
Nothing. Just a very silly friend of mine asked the question.
Was Franny interested in some man?
Alice knew that Franny had lost a boyfriend during the Second World War, but as far as she was aware, there had never been anyone else in her life since. Although there had been that time when they were teenagers, and Elizabeth had seen a half-finished letter sitting on Franny's desk. When Elizabeth asked who she was writing to, Franny had apparently been so flustered she had actually, Alice thought Elizabeth must be making this part up, blushed. She had said she was writing to an old friend, but Elizabeth had been convinced from her reaction that it was a secret lover. probably someone else's husband, Elizabeth had said with a knowing, cynical look. I expect they meet at motels in the middle of the day. Alice had been deeply shocked and wasn't able to look Franny in the eye for weeks after. Come on, let's go downstairs, said Franny. Your mother is making lunch. As they walked out of the room and down the hallway toward the stairs, Franny said, Walk alongside me, Alice. I am, said Alice. No, properly. That's it. See, we can walk side by side without tripping all over each other, can't we? We sure can, said Alice, wondering if Franny had gone a little senile in 2008. As they reached the top of the stairs, Alice stopped abruptly at the sound of a deep, familiar male voice.
Alice, my dear, I was just coming up to collect you.
How are you, Roger? Alice peered over the banister, horrified to see him at the bottom of the stairs. He was all out of context without Nick. He was a visitor you planned for, steeled yourself for, not someone who looked comfortably up at you from the bottom of your stairs, as if he belonged in your house.
Never better, Roger called back. It's you we're worried about.
Franny's eyes met Alice's, and she lifted a wry eyebrow. She wasn't senile. She was still sharp as a tack.
Is she up then?
Alice's mother emerged from the kitchen and looked up at them. Alice walked behind Franny down the stairs, glad to see that although she was behaving oddly, she didn't seem that much frailer than Alice remembered. Barb and Roger stood at the bottom with their palms lifted like ministers welcoming the congregation, identical, weirdly evangelical expressions on their faces.
Did you have a good sleep, Alice?
Asked Barb, trying in vain to take Franny's elbow. Rest is the best thing for you, I'm sure.
I suppose everything has come back to you now?
She didn't wait for an answer.
Are you hungry?
Roger took Alice by the arm and led her into the dining area, behind Barb and Franny, his fingertips solicitously pressed to the small of her back.
Don't hover, Barbara,
snapped Franny as Barb fussed about the best seat for her at the long pine table. Alice sat down next to her, anxious to escape the oily feel of Roger's fingertips. She watched in fascination at the relaxed way her mother tilted her head coquettishly up at him. Thankfully, she was no longer wearing the exotic salsa dancing outfit from the day before, but she was wearing a rather low-cut t-shirt and capri pants, and her long hair was up in a jaunty ponytail.
Now I've made a nice tuna salad for lunch. I chose that specifically for you, Alice, because fish is brain food.
Roger and I have been taking fish oil every day, haven't we, Dal?
Dal.
Her mother had just called Roger Dal. Roger didn't seem to have changed at all in the last 10 years. He was still tanned and polished and pleased with himself. Had he had plastic surgery? Alice wouldn't put it past him. He was wearing a pink polo neck shirt, with a gold chain nestled in greying chest hair. His shorts were just a little too tight, revealing muscular brown legs. As Barb turned to go back toward the kitchen, Roger gave her a playful, not at all discreet slap on the bottom. Appalled, Alice averted her eyes. Roger, she remembered, owned a waterbed.
The ladies love it, he'd told Alice once.
Franny gave a low chuckle and laid her hand over Alice's in sympathy. Alice distracted herself by examining the long pine table in front of her. She'd dreamed about this table at the hospital. Nick was sitting at it while she was cleaning the kitchen. He'd said something that made no sense.
What was it?
Elizabeth came into the room, lifting her handbag over her shoulder. I've got to go.
Where are you going?
Asked Alice desperately. She needed support to help her cope with Roger and her mother.
Are you coming back?
Elizabeth gave her an odd look.
I'm meeting some people for lunch. I'll come back if you like.
Who? Asked Alice, trying to keep her there for longer. Who are you meeting?
Just some friends, said Elizabeth evasively. Anyway, make sure you listen out for the phone, because I've left 3 messages for that Kate Harper about tonight's party, but she still hasn't called back.
She looked at Alice. You still seem very pale. I think you should go back to bed after lunch.
Oh, I agree, said their mother as she walked in from the kitchen carrying a glass salad bowl. I'm packing her straight off to bed after lunch, don't worry. We need to get her completely recovered before those little terrors are back.
Alice looked at the big glass salad bowl her mother was holding, and for no particular reason, the name Gina came into her head.
It's always about Gina. Gina, Gina, Gina.
That's right. That's what she'd remembered or dreamed Nick saying as he sat at this table. Who is Gina? Asked Alice. The room became extremely still and silent. Finally, Franny cleared her throat. Roger looked at the floor and fiddled with the chain around his neck. Barb froze at the entrance from the kitchen and hugged the salad bowl to her stomach. Elizabeth chewed hard at her lip.
Well, who is she? Said Alice.
Elizabeth's homework for Dr. Hodges. One thing I've been thinking about a lot is how I would feel if I lost 10 years of my memory, and what things would surprise me, or please me, or upset me about how my life had turned out. I hadn't even met Ben 10 years ago, so he would be a stranger. A big, scary, hairy stranger sharing my bed. How could I explain to my old self that I had accidentally fallen in love with a silent mountain of a man who designs neon signs for a living and whose most passionate interest is cars? Before I met Ben, I was one of those girls who was deliberately, prettily ignorant about cars. I described them by size and color. A big white car. A small blue car. Now I know makes and models. I watch the Grand Prix. Sometimes I even flick through his car magazines. Do you like cars, Dr. Hodges? You seem more like an art galleries and opera sort of guy. I see you have a photo of your wife and 2 small children on your desk. I secretly look at this photo every session when you're writing out my receipt. I bet your wife had no trouble getting pregnant at all, did she? Do you ever thank your lucky stars you didn't end up with a reproductively challenged wife like me? Do you give that photo an affectionate look as I walk out of the room and think, thank God my wife is a good breeder? Don't worry if you do. I'm sure it's innate. It's just biology for a man to want a woman who can give him children. I raised this with Ben once. I said he must secretly resent me, and I understood that. He got so angry, the angriest I've ever seen him. Never say that again, he said. But I bet that's why he got so angry, because he knew it was true. Before I met Ben, I used to go for witty, successful types. I'd never been out with a man before who owned a toolbox. A proper, big, dirty, well-used toolbox full of, you know, screwdrivers and stuff. It's embarrassing how aroused I became when I first saw Ben selecting a chunky, oily wrench from that toolbox. My dad had a toolbox, so maybe I'd been subconsciously waiting for a man with a toolbox. I bet you don't have a toolbox, do you, Dr. Hodges? No, I didn't think so. I used to think that one of my main prerequisites for a man was that he'd be good at dinner parties, like Alice's Nick. But Ben is hopeless at dinner parties. He always seems too big for his chair. He gets this trapped expression. It's like I brought along a big, tame chimp. Sometimes he's okay if he happens to find another man, or woman, he's no chauvinist, who could talk about cars, but mostly he's miserable. And he breathes out gustily when we get in the car as if he's been let out of jail. It's funny. I had all those years of being driven mad by Mum and Alice and their fear of social events. Oh no, they'd say tragically, and I would think someone had died. And it would turn out they'd been invited to some party or lunch where they'd only know one person. And then there would be all the strategizing about how to get out of it, and the drama of it all, and the sympathy they'd pour on each other. Oh, you poor thing. That would be awful. You absolutely must not go. I couldn't stand it, and yet I ended up marrying a man who also thinks socializing is something that's meant to be endured. Not that he's shy like they were. He doesn't get butterflies in his stomach or agonize over what people think of him. Actually, I don't think he has any self-consciousness whatsoever. He is a man without vanity. He's just not a talker. He has no small talk ability whatsoever. Whereas Mum and Alice, of course, were talkers, and they were actually interested in meeting other people. In reality, they were more social than me, but their shyness stopped them from being the outgoing people they actually were. They were like athletes trapped in wheelchairs. As it turns out, Ben and I don't really go to many dinner parties anymore. I can't stand them. I've lost my ability to chat too. I listen to people talk about their interesting full lives. They're training for marathons, they're learning Japanese, they're taking the kids camping and renovating the bathroom. I had a